Rachel T.
Hi, I'm Eva.
Hi, I'm Rachel G.
We are all Girl Scouts, and this is WGXC ACRA.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
I'm Tom Rowe in ACRA, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show. And today, Rob Gellis will speak with Peter Young, who runs a gallery on Warren Street in Hudson, on his Rob Around the County segment. We'll hear later in the show. We'll also hear the radio news about how net neutrality isn't a federal law, but since it's passed in California, it's had an impact nationwide. Plus, we'll hear the national headlines from the Public News Service and the local Better Weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate. And it all starts after the local news, which is next on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
On air, in air, waves controlled. On air, in air, channel connection. And the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. This is the network, network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network, network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network, network. And the moon turns to blood.
Alan DeVoe Bird Club will lead participants on a bird walk through the Art O' My Sculpture and Architecture Park on Saturday, April 30th from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. You might spot a green heron during the walk through 200 acres of hedgerow, woodland, grassland, and pond habitat on the Art O' My grounds in Ghent in Columbia County. Go to the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org for more information about this event and many others. You can even add your own event there at WGXC.org in the community calendar.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program, administered in Greene County by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC's sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support to Wave Farm's radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Glen Falls House in Round Top, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tom Rowe in ACRA with the WGXC Daily News for Monday, April 25th. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Pete DeMola reports for the Times Union that the St. Peter's Health Partners will begin limiting visitors to its hospitals April 24th due to the increasing COVID-19 numbers. Patients will be allowed one visitor per day in their room during visitation hours, according to the new guidelines. COVID-19 patients undergoing, quote, continuous aerosol-generating procedures, unquote, will be permitted one unique visitor per day for 1 hour. The guidelines are relaxed in some situations, including for those related to birth and end-of-life and hospice care. Visitors are strongly encouraged to be vaccinated, and face masks are required. The visitation guidelines will be in effect at St. Peter's Samaritan and Sunnyview Rehabilitation Hospitals, as well as the Albany Memorial Samaritan Campus. The hospitals announced the restrictions as Albany County is reporting higher coronavirus numbers. On April 22nd, four new deaths were announced, adding to the more than 500 new cases reported in a four-day period last week. Statewide, the seven-day average is 32 new positive cases per 100,000, a level not seen since February 8th. Two Omicron subvariants are being blamed for the recent high case counts, which started in central New York. In the capital region, newly confirmed COVID-19 cases are slightly higher than the state average, 34 cases per 100,000. St. Peter said it will also resume pre-procedural testing. Beginning this week, quote, any patient scheduled for a procedure at one of our hospitals will be required to undergo COVID-19 testing 3 days prior to their scheduled procedure, unquote, the health system said. Read more about the story in the Times Union. Milly Lekosevic is reporting for Capital Region Independent Media that the construction of the Queeman's Solar Farm project is scheduled to begin around May 6th. The project by Hecuti Energy Albany will consist of a 40-megawatt solar electric generation facility located on 428 acres in the town of Queeman's in southern Albany County between routes 9W and 101. Once completed, the solar facility is expected to supply 73,000 megawatt hours of electricity yearly, providing enough energy to power more than 10,000 average households, according to the company's website. The farm will include photovoltaic solar panels and other infrastructure, including inverters, underground collection cables, two on-site collection substations, gravel access roads, and security fencing. Work at the site will generate noticeable noise, but that work will be largely limited to the hours of 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday, according to the company. Queeman's Town Supervisor George McHugh welcomed the project. Quote, I'm excited that the solar farm is starting construction soon and very happy that Queeman's is playing such a vital role in green energy, not only with this large solar farm, but also with the offshore wind project coming to Queeman's, unquote, McHugh said. The project was approved April 14th by the New York State Public Service Commission. Queeman's Solar Farm is expected to create more than 140 temporary jobs during the construction phase. Read more about the story at theupstater.com. Natasha Von Holdridge is reporting for Columbia Green Media that the Columbia County Board of Supervisors will name the county's Fire Training Center in Ghent in honor of Emergency Medical Services Coordinator P.J. Keeler. The board's Public Safety Committee discussed the idea at a public meeting last week. Quote, I was approached by people who are in an emergency services field, whether it be firefighters, ambulance, and or emergency medical people, some of our own department's heads, that they felt it was appropriate that the Board of Supervisors dedicate and name the Emergency Training Center the P.J. Keeler Columbia County Emergency Services Response and Training Center, unquote, Board Chair Matt Morrell said. Keeler has served as the county's Emergency Medical Services Coordinator for the past 22 years, an active member of the A.B. Shaw Fire Company for 46 years, a deputy commissioner of the Claverack Fire District Board of Commissioners for 13 years, a member of the Greenport Rescue Squad for 42 years, and a member of the squad's board of directors for 40 years. The Public Safety Committee unanimously voted in favor of approving the name dedication, and the full board of supervisors will vote on the resolution in May. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com and read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at WGXC.org. The Alan DeVoe Bird Club will lead participants on a bird walk through the Art O' My Sculpture and Architecture Park on Saturday, April 30th from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. You might spot a green heron during the walk through 200 acres of hedgerow, woodland, grassland, and pond habitat on the Art O' My grounds in Ghent in Columbia County. Go to the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org for more information about this event and many others. You can even add your own event there at WGXC.org in the community calendar. This is Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Renewable Weather for Monday, April 25th. Partly sunny is the forecast from the National Weather Service with a high of 62 and a south wind from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Monday night, there's a 30% chance of showers, mainly after 2 a.m. Cloudy skies, a low around 48 and a south wind from 7 to 10 miles per hour. Tuesday, there is again a chance of showers, a 50% chance with cloudy skies, a high of 58 and a low around 40 on Tuesday night. Wednesday, there is a 20% chance of rain. Otherwise, it'll be partly sunny with a high of 46 and a low around 33. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, solar-powered community radio for open ears.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Celia Graham of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
You got to try something.
You got a job at the radio station?
Oh, great, that place. It's dark and dirty and has, like, what, those three weirdos who work there?
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times. Incumbent French President Emmanuel Macron won re-election over conservative challenger Marine Le Pen. This was Le Pen's third bid for the presidency, having lost in 2012 and 2017. Polls put Macron ahead by about 15%, which would make him the first French president in 20 years to win a second term. But the New York Times puts voter turnout at close to 60%, the lowest in two decades. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Georgia Republican, was in court Friday fending off charges of insurrection.
I was asking people to come for a peaceful march, which is what everyone is entitled to do under their First Amendment. But I was not asking them to actively engage in violence or any type of action.
Citing her inflammatory social media messages, a coalition of her constituents argue Greene violated the Constitution by collaborating with insurrectionists on January 6th. A guilty verdict could bar her from holding office. Greene says she still believes the big lie that widespread voter fraud cost Donald Trump the 2020 election. In related news, leaked audio reveals House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy planned to encourage the former president to resign following the insurrection. In a recorded call obtained by the New York Times, McCarthy tells his fellow Republicans that Trump, quote, bears responsibilities for his words and actions, no ifs, ands, or buts, unquote, and that the president had acknowledged some responsibility for the attack. McCarthy has been publicly loyal to Trump, and the former president says his relationship with the minority leader is still positive in spite of the leak. But the revelation could make it difficult for McCarthy to become speaker if Republicans win the most seats this fall. Florida's Republican lawmakers are facing a gerrymandering lawsuit over the state's new congressional voting maps. Politico reports a coalition of voting rights, civil rights, and Democrat-aligned redistricting groups filed the suit Friday, the same day Governor Ron DeSantis signed the new maps into law. President Joe Biden Friday signed an executive order which seeks to better protect the nation's forests, especially old growth. Biden pointed to reforestation as a way to fight climate change.
If you compare the map of North America in 1620 with America today, you'll see how much we've devastated our forests.
The executive order comes as some environmental groups are criticizing his opening up public lands to new oil and gas drilling. Former Utah Senator Orrin Hatch passed away Saturday at the age of 88. The longest-serving Republican in the chamber's history sponsored thousands of bills during more than four decades on Capitol Hill. In an interview when he retired, Hatch stressed bipartisan cooperation, pointing to his long legislative partnership with Democrat Ted Kennedy.
Frankly, I believe this is the most important government in the world, the most important country in the world.
I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eight trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Alan DeVoe Bird Club will lead participants on a bird walk through the Art Omai Sculpture and Architecture Park on Saturday, April 30th from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. You might spot a green heron during the walk through 200 acres of hedgerow, woodland, grassland, and pond habitat on the Art Omai grounds in Ghent in Columbia County. Go to the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org for more information about this event and many others. You can even add your own event there at WGXC.org in the community calendar. I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC Newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about any of these stories. Andrea Macko reports for Porcupine Soup that Greene County elected officials are urging their constituents to actively oppose proposed environmental initiatives that they say will have, quote, disastrous consequences on local communities, unquote. At the April 20th meeting, the county legislature unanimously adopted a resolution detailing the alleged adverse impacts on residents and businesses that lawmakers say will occur under the New York State Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. The CLCPA is one of the most ambitious climate laws in the world, celebrated by environmental groups as an important step forward in addressing global climate change. Under the Act, the New York State Climate Action Council is tasked with developing a draft plan to serve as an initial framework for how the state will reduce greenhouse gas emissions and achieve net zero emissions, increase renewable energy usage, and ensure climate justice. The plan was released in December, and public comment will be accepted until June 10th. Quote, the Greene County Legislature supports prudent action on energy efficiency, unquote, said Republican Legislative Chair Patrick Linger. Quote, however, the mandates outlined by the Climate Action Council will take us down a narrow, expensive, and risky path centered on limiting homeowner choice, preventing research and innovation, and electrifying everything, unquote, he said. Many others are not against the state's proposed plan. Representatives of the Sierra Club and Catskill Mountain Keeper both fully support the legislation, for instance. County lawmakers have directed the county planning office to submit the concerns and comments contained in the resolution adopted last week, as well as an accompanying climate report prepared for Greene, Delaware, and Schoharie counties to the New York State Climate Action Council. The legislature also directed the county planning, public works, and emergency services departments to further review the draft scoping plan and provide comments as appropriate. Read more about the story at porcupinesoup.com. Shayla Colin is reporting for the Times Union that Rensselaer Mayor Michael Stommel has for years retained control of a building that used to house the Rensselaer Volunteer Ambulance Service. However, the space is frequently rented for private events with little accountability for its business dealings and finances. Stommel said he is a member of the group's now inactive board, but refused to name any other members. He also confirmed that the nonprofit forfeited its certification last year, but continues to rent out the building at 901 3rd Street for parties and gatherings. That ongoing use has raised questions about the squad's finances and the lack of publicly available business records. Records on file with the State Attorney General's Charities Bureau also lack details of the squad's business dealings, and Stammel is the only contact listed on the group's website. A nearby resident has dubbed the 3rd Street building's status as an ambulance company-turned-party venue and, quote, open secret, unquote. The mayor said he has been on the board for 15 years and that the building remains the property of the ambulance squad board. After failing to identify the others involved, he said the board is, quote, reorganizing, unquote, and, quote, fluid, unquote. Stammel also claims to be the building's caretaker. Quote, anybody who wants information out in the neighborhood, they know how to talk to me, unquote, he said. Chris Killahoon, who lives nearby, said the rentals are, quote, consistent, unquote, and that the building was, quote, dead, unquote, before Stammel took office as mayor at the beginning of 2020. Quote, he rents that place out, unquote, Killahoon said, questioning where the funds go. Quote, maybe he's got a big stash of money there, who knows, unquote, he said. An anonymous former ambulance squad volunteer said that in 2014, a couple of years after a fire occurred in the building, Stammel and the organization's treasurer locked everyone out. Rensselaer City Council President John DeFrancesco says Stammel treats the building like his clubhouse. Quote, somehow it ends up being he's one of the last survivors and it, the building really should be sold and any money split amongst everyone, but he keeps it under his wing and uses it to his advantage, unquote, he said. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Bill Williams reports for Columbia Green Media that the destructive southern pine beetle that kills pine trees continues to move north and was recently found in Columbia County. Department of Environmental Conservation spokesperson Lori Severinos said the destructive pests have been discovered in Taconic State Park, as well as Minnewaska State Park Preserve, Shinumuk Mountain State Park, and Hudson Highlands. They were found further north than previously documented and in greater numbers, suggesting their range is expanding and populations are on the rise, DEC Commissioner Basil Sago said. Southern pine beetle poses a significant threat to the state's pine forests, specifically pitch pine forests, such as those found in the Albany Pine Bush and Minnewaska State Park Preserve, Sago said. Three infested pines at Taconic State Park were found near Sunset Rock during joint survey efforts and were subsequently removed and destroyed. Native to the southeastern United States, the southern pine beetle was first discovered infesting pitch pines on Long Island in 2014. Since then, it has killed hundreds of thousands of trees on Long Island alone. The insect attacks primarily pitch pine and red pine, but will also attack additional trees when outbreaks occur, Severino said. The DEC encourages the public to report any signs of southern pine beetles encountered in pine forests by emailing photographs and location information to foresthealth@dec.ny.gov. The signs of an infestation include discolored needles, popcorn-sized clumps of resin anywhere along the trunk, tiny holes in the bark, and in a scattershot pattern and S-shaped galleries under the bark, Severino said. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com and read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom, WGXC.org.
The Sons of Kemet get us started on the WGXC morning show today. We'll be joined by Rob Gellis talking to Peter Young in just a few minutes on the WGXC morning show. Stay tuned.
Baltimore. This is the band Matmos and their song ESP.
All right, we are now joined by Rob Gellis here for his monthly Rob Around the County segment. How are you doing these days, Rob?
Good. Very busy.
Very busy. All right. That's good. Things are getting back to normal for you?
Yeah, I'm adding things. I'm doing a lot of volunteering in the community. I do things for different organizations spend a lot of time with my dog. There's a beautiful dog park in Hudson, and I take her out almost every day. So,
oh, and it's
she plays with all these dogs.
Well, it seems like a good day for that today.
I think I'll be doing that later.
All right. Well, what do you have for us this month? Who did you talk to?
Peter Young is a art dealer and art collector, especially the Hudson River Valley art, landscape art. Mm-hmm. And he's been 30 years he's been here in Hudson as a gallery. He came here before that, but not to set up a gallery. He came here because there was a lot of tree damage at Olana back in 1986, and he and a friend came from the Midwest to clear up the trees and to take away the wood and whatever. And then he saw Hudson, and he decided then to move here.
He literally saw Hudson from the top of Olana.
Yeah, I think so. And then, of course, Hudson was different in 1986, but he obviously saw opportunities, and he liked the area, especially the Hudson Valley. I mean, from Olana, I think he just fell in love with the beauty of it, and that's what brought him to the art of it. The artists that had painted this beauty, like, Church and Thomas Cole, and then Sanford Gifford, who was a local Hudson City artist at the same time that Church was painting. He got interested in Sanford Gifford and eventually restored the gravesite that's in the Hudson City Cemetery of Sanford Gifford and his relations.
Who is Sanford Gifford?
Sanford Gifford was a artist known for the landscapes that he painted in, you know, in the Hudson Valley. His family were had been established for before this in Hudson. They had an iron mill, and they had they were quite affluent. They had a mansion that used to occupy an area that's a parking lot on Columbia Street now. And you know, he obviously Mr. Young researched this and found that the cemetery was in disrepair, and then he raised money and found the resources and restored the stones and the gravesite. So I went there. Unfortunately, I can't show you a picture on the air of it, but it's totally restored, and now Sanford Gifford, you know, is if people want to go to the cemetery, they can look for it. It's in an older section. But anyway, that's about my spiel about it.
Yeah, that sounds good. So let's hear your discussion. It sounds like Peter Young has a lot of stories to tell.
Yes, he does. Thank you so much, Tom.
All right, thank you. Here we go. We'll listen to Rob talk to Peter Young on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
Hello, this is Rob Gellis. I'm talking today to Peter Young, who has the Peter Young Fine Art Gallery. He's an art dealer in Hudson. He's been here for a long time. And Peter, I want to thank you so much for inviting me over to your gallery.
Welcome. So I came to Hudson about 32 years ago, 1990. When Hudson was just beginning to sort of wake up from its sleepy time, I had been in the Midwest originally. I'm from Minnesota. And I had not been involved with art. I didn't know anything about the Hudson River School of Painting. I didn't have any experience. I was in the violin trade. I dealt in violins. And some folks might remember that in about 1986, we had a huge, wet, heavy snowstorm that devastated the Hudson Valley. The snow built up on the trees, and the trees couldn't handle the weight, and it broke branches. The Hudson Valley looked like it had been hit with a nuclear bomb. And a friend of mine had a tree service business, and he got the contract to clean up Olana, the beautiful property just south of Hudson where Frederick Church lived in the 19th century. And I helped him work on those trees, which had been badly damaged by this snowstorm. And the director of the site at that time was a fellow named Jim Ryan. And we were taking a lunch break, and Jim said to us, "Would you guys like to see the inside of the house?" So we went inside, we set down our chainsaws and got a tour of the house, and it was just spectacular. I had never seen anything like it. And within a day or two, I was down at the Met and the New York Historical Society looking at Hudson River School paintings down in the city. And that was sort of the beginning for me. It happened so immediately, I can't explain it. It was almost like a religious transformation. I was exposed to all that great artwork and that beautiful, you know, that exotic interior of the Olana home. And it just set me on a course of being absolutely passionate about the Hudson River School. Even though I had no prior knowledge, I had no art history background, I just went at it the best way I could. And here in the Hudson Valley, we have a lot of auctions. There are a lot of antique auctions on a weekly basis. So I started visiting those auctions, buying little things here and there. And I got lucky at one point and did pretty well on a painting, which was quite encouraging. But for me, the last 32 years has been pretty much a big treasure hunt. And I've spent a ton of time driving around, seeing other dealers, visiting galleries, going to auctions, museums. I typically put anywhere from 40 to 50,000 miles on a car in a given year, so I get around. I've learned a great deal. I've got a wonderful conservator by the name of Yost Conservation. They're over in Connecticut. And a lot of the pictures that I get require some level of cleaning and touch-up and conservation. So I see them on a pretty regular basis. And I enjoy that experience. One of my favorite things to do is jump in the car with a couple of pictures that are dirty and in need of restoration and bring them to the conservator and pick up the clean ones. I think he and I have done something like 1,200 pictures over the years that have been, you know, brought back into good health, properly framed. Also, framing is a big part of the experience. When you get the right frame on a picture, it really matters. And so I spend quite a bit of time trying to frame paintings properly. And right here in my block, in the fifth block of Warren Street, there's a wonderful frame shop run by a fellow named Ami Rebar. And above him is a German gal named Tanya McGivney, who has tremendous frame conservation skills. So right here in my own block, I've got really great framing resources, and I work with them quite often.
So, obviously that you're bringing, brought you here, to Alana brought you here, but then you got exposed to the art and you started your journey.
I did serve on the board at Alana as well. I served back in, the early 90s. I served on the board for 3 years. And they're doing so well right now. And, of course, right across the river from Alana is Thomas Cole's home. And Thomas Cole is often thought of as the grandfather of the Hudson River School. And both of those houses were kind of sleepy and dormant when I first came here. But now they have terrific management and good board of directors. They're raising plenty of money. They have wonderful exhibitions. They have lectures and other events. Both of those houses are doing extremely well, and I'm really happy to see it.
Something brought you, obviously you learned who the artists were, and a local one I knew about was Sanford Gifford.
Mm-hmm.
I knew his paintings. I've seen a few at the church house myself.
Yes.
And then I'll let you discuss further how you got involved with Sanford Gifford.
Sanford Robinson Gifford was born in 1823, and his father, named Elihu, I'm not quite certain how it's pronounced, had an iron foundry here in town. They made heavy cast iron goods like frying pans and shovels. There's even a couple of sewer caps in the streets here with the Gifford brand on them. So he grew up in a beautiful Italianate mansion, which no longer exists, at the corner of 6th and Columbia, where we have the farmer's market on Saturday mornings. Unfortunately, that house was bulldozed in the 1850s, or 1950s. And that was tragic. It was just an absolutely beautiful home. I have photos of it. So Gifford grew up here in Hudson, traveled to Europe and studied over in Italy, and as many of the Hudson River painters did. And he's what's called a second-generation Hudson River painter. He's not one of that very, very first group, along with Cole, who started in the 1820s. Gifford comes along later. But he's a spectacularly great painter. I like him because he doesn't exaggerate the landscape. He pretty much paints the truth, which is nice. He doesn't give you mountains or sunsets that are over the top and ridiculous. And he's very sought after. A major Gifford painting could be a couple million bucks these days. They're a big deal. I've handled a couple of smaller examples in my days. It's interesting that when I first came to Hudson, I kind of thought that if I opened up a gallery here, some of this great Hudson River material would come walking in my front door. And that has not turned out. I'm still waiting for the sweet little old lady to come in the door with a great painting. And it took me a while to understand it. Those great artists, Church, Cole, Gifford, they were never selling their paintings up here in the country. They had wealthy clients and collectors who they were selling to in New York and Hartford and Boston, New Haven, places like that. So those paintings were not widely distributed in Columbia County. If we're lucky, we might find a little sketch or some sort of preliminary drawing or something. But the great important Hudson River paintings were expensive in their day. They were thousands of dollars even in the 1850s. So that material is not bubbling up out of grandmother's cupboard up here in Columbia County. So I'm still waiting for that to happen. But Gifford is a great one. The real connoisseurs of Hudson River paintings hold Gifford in very high esteem. So about 8 or 9 years ago, I was walking through our local cemetery with a friend and her dog, and we're just taking a walk because the cemetery is a pleasant place to spend some time. And I came up to a whole plot of Giffords, about 22 of them, all of them in bad shape. The stones tipped over, neglected. There was no maintenance of the site at all. And I thought, gee, is it possible that this is the Gifford family? And I walked up to a stone, and sure enough, there he was, Sanford Robinson Gifford. He was kind of buried under a bush right next to his wife, Mary. A few of the stones were cracked and broken. A number of them were tipped over. And I nearly had a heart attack. I thought, my God, this is the great Gifford, and nobody's paying attention to his gravesite. So I called one of my best art clients, a really felt good fellow here in Columbia County, and the next day he came down and wrote me a pretty substantial check to get going on the conservation of the site. And I found a brilliant young stonemason by the name of Aldo Lavaggi. Aldo had grown up down near Woodstock working with blue stone and other stone, and he spent about 4 months up at the gravesite and got it all beautifully put back together. He did a fabulous job. And I put up a little sort of blog about it. You can Google it. If you search for Gifford's grave, you'll see the little website that I put up. And so now Gifford, his family plot is in good shape. And what this did is to help trigger a bit more interest in our beautiful old cemetery. Because our cemetery was designed according to the principles of the rural cemetery movement, which is something I had no idea about. It's a really cool idea. In the 1820s, 30s, 40s, the big European cities like Rome, Madrid, Paris, Berlin, they were having a problem with too many corpses stacking up in cemeteries. The cemeteries were right in the central city, and it was literally a public health issue. So they decided, let's build brand new cemeteries out in the country, outside the city. That's where the term rural cemetery comes from. And the brilliance of this notion is that they said, if you're going to put a cemetery, a brand new cemetery, out in the country, why not make it a beautiful place like a park? So you have a winding path and beautiful architecture and pools and ponds and benches, and make it an attractive place so that people would actually rather use it as a living space as opposed to thinking of it as a dark and scary place for the dead. And it's a really wonderful concept. So that notion spread to the United States, and we have some of those here in the Northeast. The most magnificent one is in Boston. It's called Mount Auburn, and it's just amazing. It's got a big citizens auxiliary group that supports it. It's just fabulous. There's a great one up in Troy called Oakwood. And our little cemetery, which needs millions of dollars worth of renovations, is a kind of small version of that. But the idea is, let's use our cemeteries as parkland rather than avoid them. And so the discovery of Gifford's grave, I think, has helped to trigger in some people the notion that we ought to start spending time in our cemeteries. Take a walk, hang out with your dog or your kids or whatever, read a book, and use the cemetery. And I think it's a lovely concept. So to the extent that Gifford's grave has helped to stimulate that, you know, that movement, I'm very pleased about it. So Gifford is, he's probably, of all the Hudson River painters, he's probably the one I feel closest to, partially because he grew up a block from the gallery here. And by the way, I shouldn't forget Henry Airy. If we were to go out in my front door, to the right, just one door, at 508 Warren Street, was a fellow named Henry Airy. Last name is A-R-Y. He came here from Rhode Island in the 1840s, and he opened up a little art supply shop, and he taught painting right here on Warren Street. He was Gifford's first teacher. And his pictures pop up. He painted South Bay and Mount Marino down here quite often. He's a little on the folky side. He's not as polished as some of the Hudson River painters who studied in Europe, but his pictures are very charming. And I often wonder if Frederick Church, Gifford, Thomas Cole, some of these other people weren't actually coming and buying their paints and canvas and brushes right here, a door from my shop. So I can't prove it, but it's possible. He had an art supply store right here on the main street.
And now there's one down just below it, the Spotty Dog.
Spotty Dog, yes, yeah.
So
yeah.
And I didn't know that Hudson had one over 100 years ago.
Yeah, it came here in the 1840s. And I've handled probably 5 or 6 of his paintings. And he's, like I said, he's not one of the high priests of Hudson River School painting, but he's a good one. And he has a place in history because of the fact that he was here, taught Gifford, and I'm sure he knew Church and all those guys. They must have spent time together. Who knows, they might have gone on painting and sketching trips together. Artists often did that. They'd go out together and spend an afternoon painting and sketching together. But the Hudson River School of Painting is something that isn't as widely known as I wish it were. I grew up in the Midwest, never heard of it. It wasn't taught in schools, not a mention of the Hudson River School of Painting. It wasn't until I happened to get lucky and stumble into Olana because of a winter snowstorm that I even learned about the Hudson River School. I keep thinking it would be fantastic if Ken Burns would do one of those documentaries. You know, he's done the Civil War and jazz and baseball and other things like that. And he does a spectacular job with these documentaries. Wouldn't it be great if he took on the Hudson River School? Because it is so integrated into American culture. There were 3 big things happening while the Hudson River School painters were at work. The Civil War, which of course impacted everyone. The spreading out of the railroads across the country, which completely changed, it was a game changer. The Erie Canal, which was an economic boon to the United, or to the northeastern United States. And then the movement of settlers out of the Northeast, where farming wasn't so easy on this rocky, hilly, treed country, moving westward towards Ohio and Minnesota and Wisconsin, the Dakotas, where farming was much more viable. So this all happened at a time when the Hudson River painters were at work, you know, and America was flexing its muscles and moving westward. So if someone like Ken Burns were to take on the documentary, it would be an easy one. Number one, all the imagery is already there. We've already got all the imagery.
Is it possible to approach his organization?
I do have one connection. I know a musician who has a connection to him through Ken's series on the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if they took on that challenge, the imagery is all there. It's all documented. There's 100, 200 books about the Hudson River School. The scholarship is done. I think the big challenge would be to somehow tell the story of it in a way that made it meaningful and integrated it into the story of American history. And it would just be spectacular. Plus, the visuals would be so stunning and wonderful. You know, there's nothing more attractive than showing a luminous painting. The other thing that I should mention is that if you were an American living in the Northeast, let's say New York or Pennsylvania, in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, it wasn't necessarily easy for you to know what the rest of the country looked like. You didn't have cell phones and TVs and laptop computers to transmit all that imagery into your life. So the Hudson River painters, to some extent, were helping America discover its own landscape. And somewhere here I've got a beautiful book called, what's it called? It's in the back, doggone it. Anyway, it's a beautiful book that was published in the 1860s where the editor of the book commissioned 150 different artists to go out into the United States and come back with these pen and ink drawings. And so this is a way for Americans living here in the Northeast who had never seen the Grand Canyon or the Rockies or Glacier or any of the grand scenery of the West, the Mississippi Valley. And the other way that this material is important, and the other reason Hudson River painters deserve a lot of credit, our legislators in Washington had never been to these magnificent natural settings. So to establish the national park system, they relied to a large extent on the imagery being brought back by these painters. And so the establishment of the national park system was not easy. They were fighting against logging interests, mining interests, other competing commercial interests. And to get that park system established was no easy thing. But the imagery was so spectacular and so wonderful that the legislators in Washington were able to get it done. Now, the Hudson River School of Painting kind of went into a long, quiet period of decline, sort of between, I would say, 1900 and about 1980. For some reason, it just sort of fell off the radar. People weren't paying attention. It was not appreciated as much as it could be. But sometime in the 80s and 90s, it started to enjoy a revival. And people started paying attention again and understanding how great these works really are. And now, of course, there's a tremendous amount of interest and activity. And because of the internet, the imagery is circulating around. And now anytime a good painting comes up for sale, there's tremendous interest. Now, one of my regrets is that back in the earlier days of this business, you might have a chance to buy a good painting at a country auction. Not anymore. Because now the country auctioneers have websites. And so if a good painting comes up for sale, it is widely advertised. Everybody in New York City knows about it. There's a feeding frenzy. And so the old kind of romantic game of finding fresh goods coming right out of grandma and grandpa's home is not happening anymore. But every once in a while, something great still comes up. And there are now some young contemporary painters taking up the Hudson River School again. And so there are young people who are pursuing, you know, the path of the Hudson River School again. And I'm very appreciative and supportive of them. They need to get a paycheck once in a while, and it's so rewarding for them.
Is there a way, would it be nice a way sometime is to have a little exhibit, have some of these artists come here, where you could place their art, where people would know, here's these new young people.
Right, right.
I don't know how you do it. Find a space, make it an exhibit.
Yep.
Because I would think people would be interested in it.
Yep. I am a one-person operation, so I've never had the staffing ability to do proper shows requires a big effort. You got to be in touch with all the artists.
Yeah.
You got to rehang the gallery and revamp the website, paint the walls, have the wine and cheese party on Saturday. It's a significant undertaking.
Yeah.
And since I'm also focused on older pictures, and I travel a fair amount, I've never quite had the energy and the capacity to present shows in the gallery. But you're right. It would be nice for me to have, let's say, take five of these contemporary artists and say, for the next 6 weeks, we're going to show them in the gallery.
Yeah,
you know, that would be a good thing. It's...
Wow. Peter, I want to thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Dick, he's wearing a skirt. Here comes Jane, you know she's sporting a chain. Same hair, evolution. Same build, evolution. Tomorrow, who's gonna fuss? And they love each other so androgynous. Closer than you know, love each other so. Don't get him wrong, don't get him mad. He might be a father, but he sure ain't a dad. And she don't need advice to send to her. She's happy the way she looks. She's happy with her gender. And they love each other so androgynous. Closer than you know, chunk of soap and all.